atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. It's an exciting day. A lot going on. We're going to be joined this hour by Senator Ted Cruz, as well as Steve Hilton, Fox News contributor, serves as director of strategy for the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, at the time, now foreign minister. He's here in studio. But we have a lot going on today. It's a day off from the trial. That is true. We also watched the mayor of D.C. have a press conference to talk about the breakup of the encampments at George Washington University. Just 2 weeks after they wrapped George Washington's statue in Palestinian paraphernalia, now she goes to Capitol Hill. We'll discuss that in a moment. But first, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Well, I think the Department of Justice needs to investigate where the money is coming from. Donald Trump were president of the United States. His attorney general would be all over this. These college presidents would be under the gun to stop this crap.
It's true, but they're not. Investigate and crush. That's the call from Congress and me to try and end this anti-Israeli, anti-Jew hatred nationwide, especially on college campuses. This is well-financed by anti-American forces and has to be stopped.
Number two.
We've seen a ferocious surge of anti-Semitism in America and around the world. On college campuses, Jewish students blocked, harassed, attacked. Too many people denying, downplaying, rationalizing, ignoring.
Yeah, President Biden's anti-Semitism speech is strong, but his actions with Israel are weak and unacceptable as he withholds arms to an ally because of his own re-election fortunes, who is in the middle of a conflict.
Number one.
But the cross-exam, boy, her responses were disastrous. I mean, do you hate Donald Trump? Yes, of course she does. That's a big deal. When the witness hates the person whose liberty is at stake, that's a big damn deal.
And to say that on CNN, it's a bigger damn deal. Train wreck time at the Trump trial, classless, unhinged, unbalanced, porn actress Stormy Daniels, wild testimony on the stand Tuesday. It could cost prosecution dearly. I thought this was about campaign payments. We only heard about X-rated action. Even the judge sided with the defense as Trump gets a major win on the documents case in Florida, at least a delay. Steve Hilton, so much going on. Great to see you in person. Before you go back to California, right?
Exactly. I'm here on a flying visit, mainly to see you. I mean, that's really what it's all about when I'm here.
I have reports contrary to that, Steve. I think there was other objectives to coming here.
Just don't believe these people.
Don't believe it.
They're lying. It's fake news.
All right. I've heard that expression before. First off, can we talk about what happened yesterday at trial? Just in terms of this woman going off on the stand and the judge letting them get into details and then blaming the defense for not objecting more. I mean, come on, what are you talking about?
Well, I think yesterday confirmed so many things that we've been talking about for this trial. First of all, it absolutely confirmed what Trump's been saying all along. You have this person on there, totally, as all our legal analysts have been saying, what she's saying is irrelevant to the actual case, but she's on there anyway. Why? To damage Trump, to destroy his reputation. In other words, yesterday truly confirmed that this is election interference. It is entirely political. It's not a real trial. Yes, we can talk about the back and forth on the law, but above all, it's a political event in our country. It's a total farce, and that's what yesterday showed.
You have a judge that donated to Joe Biden. You have a lead prosecutor that worked for Joe Biden. And Letitia James. You have a judge whose daughter is a Democratic operative and consultant working for Adam Schiff. And now you have a president of the United States, who former president of the United States, leading in all the polls, sitting in trial for weeks. Now, keep in mind, and this is what the New York Post says, you were not in the U.S. during the Clinton era, but I'm sure you followed it.
Yes.
His ratings went up after the explicit details of Monica Lewinsky came out. Can you equate it to American 2024, to the America in the 1990s? Does the same thing apply?
I think there's a sense of fairness and justice in a deep sense, not in the kind of just narrow legal sense, but real justice. And people think, no, this is not how we do things. And it's a point I've been making. If you look at this trial that's going on here in New York and you compare it to other countries where you've seen this kind of thing happen just in the last few months, just within the last year, in Pakistan, In Pakistan, they resorted to legal action.
Guy won, and they said no.
Exactly. But they used these same mechanisms. In Putin's Russia, right? Putin, the great evil of our time, according to the Democrats, right? That's exactly what he did just now. He had a presidential election, cooked up some bogus legal procedure to get his opposition rival off the ballot. So that is the company we're now in, thanks to these Democrats. Pakistan and Putin's Russia. I think that's what people are so upset about, and that's why Trump support is growing, because they see all this going on. They also see, by the way, the world in chaos. We'll talk about that in a second. Everything falling apart. Biden completely clueless. And they actually want someone who can sort things out. But instead of being there to give them that message, he's stuck in a court.
So Joe Biden gave a good speech yesterday. Right. Good.
Against anti-Semitism. Yes. Well, he read out a good speech. Let's just put it like that.
He didn't even say, well, Islamophobia is bad, too. I expected that. He didn't do that. Yes. We are at the Holocaust Museum. Why should you? Understood. But he waited 3 weeks to do it. He should have done it first off instinctively. You know, just go right away. Give me a camera. I'm saying this right now. What is happening right now in Colombia? What I'm seeing screamed at the streets at cops has got to stop. Why do you need anybody to tell you that?
Well, exactly. And that's why the truth is, and that word instinctively is so important. We saw what he said instinctively. It was when he was, you know, stumbling around in the woods the other week, right? And he was asked about this. Then he did exactly what you just said he didn't do yesterday. He was asked about the anti-Semitism. He said, yeah, I condemn it. And then immediately went to, I also condemn Islamophobia. That was his first response. That's what he actually thinks. Why? Because all of this is secondary for him to the main thing, and which has been the main thing all his life, not principle or values or beliefs or anything, just his own political success. And you see in him political calculation all the time. Instead of conviction, it's calculation. Instead of anything resembling a core set of beliefs on any issue, this is what I've always said about Biden. He's a totally weak, unprincipled machine politician. He'll do whatever it takes to climb the ladder for himself. And that is why he's been all over the place on every single issue, and in particular this one.
So I want you to hear, for example, a guy is acting with instinct, the guy with the hoodie, Senator John Fetterman, is coming off a stroke.
Right.
He's not able to speak. And when he is, he said this to yesterday, cut 15.
I don't know why they seem to. I'm not even sure what they're really, you know, protesting about. If you ask them, they're not really sure. They can't, you know, and now they're not talking about ceasefires anymore. And now they're talking about divesting and harming Israel on that. It's crazy. And they really just broke the mold yesterday when they were had protesters at Auschwitz yesterday during the Holocaust, the 2 mile walk thing. I mean, like, how much more tasteless and disgusting that could be. And as I said this, that it's actually working against peace in Gaza. And Hamas is convinced that they've won the PR war. And they keep seeing all these kinds of protests across the nation on these campuses. And it's not helpful, but it's actually works against peace, I think.
He's not reading cards.
Yeah.
It's just the right
thing
to do, right?
Incredibly impressive. He's really found his voice. And he speaks clearly and beautifully about this issue. And we should really be appreciative of that, because it's not easy in today's Democratic Party, because the minute you step out of line, they come down on you, right? And that's why that's the contrast. Totally weak Biden. He'll do whatever it takes. He'll stay in line. But Fetterman there really acting with strength.
But if you see what's happening right now, you know, there was a story in the New York Times yesterday. I think we might have discussed. Oh, no, it was 2 days ago when we were on Martha's show. But there was a story in the New York Times yesterday that even though China and Russia and Iran are not behind this, they are instigating this. They're bringing it out. They're amplifying all this unrest.
Yes.
So why would it be that these college kids want to make sure more Palestinians are here and more Palestinian professors are here? Why would you want a Palestinian professor? And what was brought up to me, and I should have come up with this myself, is what have Palestinians taught from day one? Israel doesn't exist. They showed maps without Israel on it. And from day one, you live to kill Jews.
Yes.
So why would you bring that mindset into America unless you wanted America to get more of that mindset?
Well, it shows you what's going on the left, actually, which is true. And it's almost any issue you look at, because on the face of it, it doesn't make sense. None of it makes sense. And you can connect it to things like the climate policy and the crime policies and all these things that you think, well, why would you do this? None of it makes sense, because they are completely consumed by ideology. And that is what's really going on. You've had this far left ideology, and it has grown from the universities. Not all the students buy into it, but at its core, it is all these things are connected for them. The critical theories on race and gender and now the environment, they keep adding to it. And the Palestinian situation, which they describe as colonialism in their ideology, is absolutely part of the same far-left worldview that they apply to every other issue.
So I wanted to see, I thought this was interesting because I saw a poll from November that said the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was the 15th most important thing for college kids. And then I saw this poll that just came out between May 3rd and May 6th, yeah. Axios, called the Generational Lab. They asked kids, what are the most important issues to you? Number one is healthcare reform. Two is educational funding and access. Number three is economic fairness. Number four is racial justice. Number five is climate change. Number six is gun control. Seven is immigration. Eight is national security and terrorism. Nine is the conflict in the Middle East. But yet they're overrunning streets and campuses on their ninth most important issue?
I know, but there you are, you see. This is symptomatic of the wider point. You have a small faction, a far-left faction. In this immediate sense, they've taken over the campuses, and they're dominating the whole conversation and life, and these pathetic leaders, so-called leaders on colleges, are caving to them, right? Canceling commencement, all the stuff, right, that we've seen. To a tiny group, actually. But again, you compare it to what's going on in politics. That's the same with the Democratic Party, but they've caved to the far left. Most Democrats don't believe in this far left nonsense on climate and race and gender and all the rest of it. And here's another comparison with Clinton. Bill Clinton, to be fair to him, in the 80s, when the Democratic Party was drifting off to the far left, he actually stood up to it. He said, no, this is crap. We don't believe in this stuff. We believe.
But he also said, I lost this House. Rather and the Senate, so rather than just be irrelevant, he'll go, let's go cut deals. And he basically stole Newt Gingrich's agenda, cut some deals, and balanced the budget.
Right.
Imagine that, people working together. But I don't want to keep bringing you back to England because you live here now in California. But I do notice that the rallies are even bigger in London.
Yes.
Anti-Israeli rallies, anti-Semitism, even bigger in London.
Yeah, and you've got a much more dominant and actually a really obscene thing that happened. Just which I saw cause a huge amount of offense. Just now, they had local elections in England. And in one, I can't remember the exact details, but in one of the districts in the north of England, a very, very Muslim-dominated district, the first thing that a winning candidate said was Allahu Akbar, right, on winning in a local election. And people were just horrified. Like, what is going on in our country? And the truth is, this is something I remember engaging in with David Cameron after we had the bombings on the subway and the buses in London years ago. And the difference with 9/11 was that in 9/11, it was foreigners coming to America to hurt Americans. In the UK case, it was all British people born and raised in England who planted those bombs and killed all those people.
You've let too many people in from other countries who have no interest in being part of England?
It's the second part. You know, I'm pro-immigration, but on these basic terms, which is that you come to our country, whether it's the UK or America, then you sign up to what we believe in here. You don't get to bring with you whatever worldview or belief system you have.
Is it too late?
Impose it.
Is it too late?
Well, we tried hard to fight, but it was called multiculturalism. That was the concept, that you just come in and you do your own thing. And we said, no, we have to be a British society, cohesive. And I don't know, we tried our best. I mean, I wasn't there for very long after he became prime minister. I don't think it's, I mean, you can just look at the evidence. Mm-hmm. No, it hasn't worked.
So you have a chance when people step up. And one was, I give Wes Moore, looks like he stepped up when that bridge collapsed. He's trying to take a lead. Governor Gavin Newsom, he has let USC go to hell, cancel their commencement. I don't see him anywhere. You saw what happened to UCLA.
Yes.
First, they had counter-protesters come in. The next day, they broke up the encampment. They're pursuing the counter-protesters. They're not pursuing the people that started the encampment and defiled the property.
That was his first comment.
So where
is he? To criticize the police.
Is he as afraid as Joe Biden of dividing his own party by speaking strongly?
This is, and you see also the lieutenant governor in California, Lainey Kunalakis, right, who's actually on the board of the UC Regents, right? So directly responsible for what goes on in the University of California system. And it's not just those big ones, UCLA, USC in the northern part of the state.
Santa Cruz.
And well, in Humboldt, right? They've canceled the rest of the semester. Like, just canceled it. It's all gone. Not even, you know. So this is just an exact example of what we're talking about here, which is weakness in the face of bullying and intimidation and not standing up for the decent, hardworking majority.
A few more minutes with Steve Hilton. I want to talk about the case and what it means and also talk a little bit more about California. And then we're on with Senator Ted Cruz, Foreign Relations Committee also, in a tough fight in Texas at a week in which we get a major station in Texas, KLIF over in Dallas. What is going on there? Can that seat actually flip? This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Out of the gates and ready to go.
Hey, it's Hutton Withrow. Hot Mike is here on the Outkick Network. We've got your afternoon covered with the latest sports discussion, and it's available wherever you find your audio.
Daily analysis and news. He is hot. I am Mike. Actually, my name is Chad. His name is Jonathan, but you get the picture. We're going to bring it every single day. Whatever you want to call us, we'll respond to. We just want you to respond to what we're dishing out every day.
And while you're here, we hope you're subscribed to the podcast. Like, subscribe, and share.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think there's two categories. I mean, there's obviously the Tim Scott category, as you said. That's embarrassing to watch. Cringy. I've watched it many times. I think many of them want to be close to power. They also assume or have this thought in their mind that maybe Donald Trump will go away. Maybe he'll go to jail. Maybe he will die. Not to be too morbid, but maybe, I mean, he's not a young man. Who knows what's in their minds? They think maybe I will be behind the Oval Office. Maybe I will be in the Oval Office.
That is Jen Psaki on another network saying that the reason why people are close to Trump and following him, because he will probably die. Steve Hilton, do you agree with that? I mean, could you believe that assessment?
It's amazing, especially from someone who worked for Biden. I mean, for goodness sake.
Who is older than old?
Okay, let's not get the morbid aspect of it. I think what's so fascinating, I just heard that for the first time, what's so revealing about that is actually fits very nicely with that insane tweet from that former CNN journalist. You know, the thing about the MAGA. Oh, my God, can you believe these people?
Undercover MAGA supporters that they act normal, and then it came out during a party, and they're going to quietly support Donald Trump.
Exactly, and what's in common with these things is that these people on the left and in the media, and they literally cannot understand. They cannot imagine why any normal person would support Donald Trump or these days the Republican Party and his agenda on the merits. They just can't see it. And so they're so consumed with their kind of demented anti-Trump rage, they end up believing their own sort of nonsense about threat to democracy and everything. They just can't put themselves in the shoe they have. And these are the people who endlessly lecture us about, you know, compassion and empathy and whatever. They have no empathy in the sense of understanding how other people
think. Do you think part of it is, I've been telling you over and over again how bad he is. What do you mean? Why are you not listening to me?
That's another great point.
Why are you not listening to me?
It's a great point. Don't you see? He's a threat.
I've been telling you this.
I think that's exactly right.
And in the last poll, they looked at everything that Trump's winning on, immigration, on the economy, on the border. Okay. The last thing, he's tied with Biden on threat to democracy.
I know. That's brilliant.
Because you look at a guy that is doing upending the student loans, letting our borders go wild, deciding to pander to every focus group out there. And they go, well, that's pretty much a threat to democracy. They're also upending our foreign policy.
But the other thing that's hilarious is if you watch them, that when they do their polls, and actually this is a little bit of a nerdy point, but very often you'll see a poll splashed on MSNBC or CNN, where they say the top issue for voters is threat to democracy. And they have a poll that shows that. But that's because they ask, right? They put it there. And of course people think you should say that. When it's an open list, it comes like number 20.
I know. Just like with the campus protests. It's ninth most important thing. Steve Hilton, go impress Bill Hemmer and Dana Perino, okay?
I'll see you soon.
Great to see you in person. I know you have a big announcement somehow, some way, right? Senator Ted Cruz next.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Well, I think the Department of Justice needs to investigate where the money's coming from. There's two classes of people here. Anti-Semites. If you say we are Hamas and you mean it, then you're a religious Nazi. If you say we are Hamas and you don't know what Hamas is all about, you're a dumbass. So there's dumbasses and there's terrorist sympathizers. And how do you fix this? When in November? Here's what I can promise you. If Donald Trump were president of the United States, his attorney general would be all over this. These college presidents would be under the gun to stop this crap.
And the protests are just maddening because they did a YouGov study and they said only 28% of the country support the protests. And then they do a study with Axios and they say what matters most to college kids. This is just last week. The ninth most important thing is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the Middle East. So why are they taking over the streets in almost every major college campuses across 27 states, including in Texas? Senator Ted Cruz joins me now. Foreign Relations Judiciary Committee up for re-election. Senator, you heard Lindsey Graham. I don't think you disagree with what he says. Can you make sense of what's happening?
Well, sadly, the radicals have taken over our universities, and they're the administrators, they're the professors, and they're in the business of poisoning young people. They're in the business of radicalizing young people, and we've allowed this to happen, and we're seeing really the poisoned fruits of decades of Marxism in our university campuses. What's being taught to our students is cultural Marxism, is dividing the world into victims and oppressors. And the radical leftists, they have defined Jews, and note that I said Jews and not Israelis. Every Jew on the planet, the radical left defines as an oppressor. And they've defined Palestinians as victims. And for the cultural Marxists, once you put them into those categories, the result is you support the violent revolution of the so-called victims against the so-called oppressors. It's why these leftists, why these students are cheering on Hamas. They're cheering on October 7th, the mass murder of 1,200 civilians, raping women and children. To the cultural Marxists, that's just bloody revolution, and they're in support of it.
So what could an investigation reveal? It could reveal who's behind these organizations, and it could reveal that supporting it from 30,000 feet is China, Iran, and Russia. So they're pushing any issue that divides America, they're amplifying it. As a story in the New York Times yesterday, they haven't linked it directly to those countries, but they all are amplifying it through social media. What would stop Joe Biden from doing an investigation in this? What's partisan about that?
What would stop him is he doesn't want to because his administration agrees with the protesters. The administration of the universities agree with the protesters. And two important stories that broke this weekend. Number one, Politico broke the story that many of the biggest funders of these anti-Israel, anti-Semitic college protesters are Joe Biden's biggest donors and the Democrat
yep.
Party's biggest donors.
Politico.
That includes George Soros. That includes Bill and Melinda Gates. That includes the Rockefeller brothers. That includes the Pritzkers. And it's the same people that are funding both because they support both outcomes. I'll point out, by the way, Brian, it is time for every Democrat that has taken hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars from George Soros and Bill and Melinda Gates and the Rockefeller brothers and the Pritzkers to return the money. Joe Biden doesn't get to claim that he opposes what they're funding if he keeps taking their money. And that's true for Biden. It's true for every other Democrat. And I'll tell you, my opponent in my Senate race, Colin Allred, has taken tens of thousands of dollars from the same Democrat gazillionaire donors who are funding the anti-Semitic protests on campuses. He needs to return that money, and so does Joe Biden.
Senator Ted Cruz, our guest, obviously. Hey, Senator, I think that you go back to the philanthropy wing of Goldman Sachs. They support some
yep.
of these organizations. They caused all the unrest in Colombia. It's not okay for a big company just to write a check and say, I don't care what happens to it.
Look, there needs to be real transparency in terms of where the money is going. There's a second factor that broke this summer, broke this weekend, rather, that lays out another reason this is happening, which is the percentage of students at a university that are foreign students. Now, do you know what three of the top four student universities in America are for the highest percentage of foreign students?
One, Columbia. Don't they have 14,000?
So NYU is number one. Northeastern is number two. Columbia is number three, and USC is number four. The state, the universities where this is happening are universities that have brought in NYU has 21,453, Columbia has 20,347, USC has 18,437. They are bringing in foreigners who hate Israel, who are vicious racists, and who hate America, who are chanting death to America, who are burning American flags. And if you have a student visa and you're chanting death to America, you ought to be deported. We have no obligation to bring people into this country who hate this country. A student visa is a permissive visa, and if the Biden administration actually wanted to lead, they would deport these foreign students that are threatening violence and threatening Jewish students at these schools.
You think Trump will if he wins?
Yes. Yes. Look, I think it would be dramatically different if Trump were president. You would see real leadership, number one. You would see the administration opening civil rights investigations into every one of these universities that is allowing Jewish students to be threatened. The Orthodox rabbi at Columbia University sent out an email to every Jewish student saying, go home. Do not come back to campus because you are not safe. Columbia cannot and will not protect your safety. That is, on its face, a civil rights violation that is against federal law. But Joe Biden and the Democrats support the protesters, so they're not willing to use the federal government to protect those Jewish students. You know, Brian, think back to the 1950s when President Dwight D. Eisenhower, a Republican, was in the White House, and you had racist Democrats in the South who refused to allow African-American children to be integrated into school. Dwight D. Eisenhower sent in the National Guard. He said, we're going to enforce federal law, and if you refuse to do it, we will. I think Trump would have done the same thing. I think the chances of Joe Biden doing that are 0.0% because, bizarrely, he wants the votes of these protesters. This is a significant wing of the Democrat Party, the pro-Hamas wing of the Democrat Party, and that really is a frightening, frightening development.
So we're talking to Ted Cruz right now, who's in a tough fight because they're targeting him. More money's going into his opponent in the Ted Cruz race in Texas than any other Republican. They want to see if they can knock him out, Rick Scott out, because they know they're in trouble in Montana. They know they're in trouble in Maryland. They know they're in trouble in West Virginia. They know they're in trouble in Ohio. They know they're in trouble in Pennsylvania. So they got to take out a stalwart. So people don't sleep on the Ted Cruz race. Senator, let me ask you, I'm watching Ron DeSantis go really, gloves were off during the primary, and they went at it hard. And 2 weeks ago, he went over and met with Trump, and they're fine. I watched you and Marco Rubio go at it as hard as any people I've ever seen in the primaries. Now, Marco Rubio has been considered the vice president. I know you're a confidant to President Trump. Why were you personally able to get over it, and now you guys work together for the last 6 years? And why do you think Nikki Haley doesn't seem to be?
Well, listen, the simple answer is we got a job to do. And can primaries be rough? Absolutely. In 2016, Trump and I went at it. We stood in the arena and we punched each other as hard as we could, and we kept on fighting. And I beat him in 12 different states all over the country, and came very, very close to winning, but at the end of the day, he prevailed. And when he prevailed, he was the nominee. I supported him. When he became elected president, I was his single closest ally in the Senate. And the reason is simple. I'm elected to represent 30 million Texans. We had an extraordinary opportunity to win big policy differences, to make a difference in the lives of Texans. And so I rolled up my sleeves and went to work hand in hand with President Trump. We passed the biggest tax cut of a generation. We repealed job-killing regulations. The result was the economy took off. We saw the lowest unemployment in 50 years, the lowest African-American unemployment ever recorded, the lowest Hispanic unemployment ever recorded. We worked together and secured the southern border. We saw the lowest rate of illegal immigration in 45 years. And we also worked together, defeated ISIS. We had peace and prosperity across the globe. That's what Joe Biden inherited, and that's what he screwed up. And by the way, we're going to do the exact same thing next year. Brian, I believe this is going to be a very good election. I think Donald Trump will be reelected. I think we'll grow our majority in the House, and I think Republicans are going to take the majority in the Senate. You noted my race. My race, Chuck Schumer has made clear, my reelection this year is his number one target. He is going to spend over $100 million trying to beat me. My last race, I won by less than 3 points. It was the most expensive Senate race in U.S. history, and they're coming after me. And so I want to encourage your listeners to go to our website. It's tedcruz.org. Go to tedcruz.org, make a contribution, give $25, $50, $100. If you can, $500 or $1,000. We're going to have more than $100 million, and the way we withstand that is each of you going to tedcruz.org and standing up and saying, we're going to defend freedom. We're going to get back to sanity in America.
All right, now I want to go to the Trump trials. If he can get out of the courtroom, he'll go back to campaigning. Well, the other one seemed to be in a delay of game. This one's ongoing for at least a few more weeks. Yesterday, yep. Stormy Daniels took to the stump. You know law as well as anyone. What people have told us and what people even in CNN have said is that Stormy Daniels up there telling salacious details about encounters that she say may have happened, but Senator had nothing to do with the case to the point where the judge said, yeah, you're right. They went in too much detail, but you didn't object enough. And the president came out yesterday and said, I think I had a good day. He was trying to put a spin on it. What is the approach to putting someone on the stand that seemingly doesn't move the ball forward to convict the former president? Because she doesn't talk about payments. She doesn't talk about who wrote the check. And what does that have to do with the election?
Look, the purpose is what everyone thinks it was. It was to go into the gutter. It was to try to smear Trump. This is being driven by a radical prosecutor who is a Democrat who hates Donald Trump. The judge is a radical Democrat who hates Donald Trump. This is blatant election interference. That's what they're trying to do. You now have the judge threatening to put Donald Trump in jail. By the way, my podcast today is entirely on the topic of whether Trump will go to jail and what that would look like. It's Verdict with Ted Cruz. We get into that in real depth today. And the short answer is I don't believe we will see Trump go to jail, although this judge is threatening it repeatedly. I don't think he will order it, and I think if he did order it, I think the appellate court would reverse it before Trump actually went to jail. But I'll say this, Brian. If Trump actually went to jail because this left-wing partisan hates him so much, I think it would guarantee the election for Trump in November. I think it would be, from the perspective of left-wing Democrats, a catastrophic step. They just might be crazy enough to do it, but I think they won't.
Here's what CNN's analyst Eli Honig said about the testimony and the cross-examination of Stormy Daniels. Cut six.
But the cross-exam, boy, her responses were disastrous. I mean, do you hate Donald Trump? Yes, of course she does. That's a big deal. When the witness hates the person whose liberty is at stake, that's a big damn deal. And she's putting out tweets, fantasizing about him being in jail. That really undermines the credibility. The fact that she owes him $500,000. She, by order of a court, owes Donald Trump $500,000 and said, I will never pay him. I will defy a court order. The defense is going to say she's willing to defy a court order. Why? She's not willing to respect an order of a judge. Why is she going to respect this oath she took? So I thought it went quite poorly on cross-exam.
And that's so significant for CNN, yeah, who's making a living off convicting him.
No, look, that's exactly right. CNN, they cover all day long the Trump trial. It's the only news that occurs. You know, the college campus protests, the anti-Israel, anti-Semites that are the base of the Democrat Party, they can't be bothered to cover that. They can't be bothered to cover the illegal immigrants released by Joe Biden that are murdering American citizens day after day after day. They can't be bothered to cover the actual real news that is hurting American families. Instead, they just obsess about the Trump trial and understand the reason. This is not about any conduct that Trump did or didn't do. This is about the election in November. This is about partisan Democrats are terrified that the American people will elect Donald Trump in November, and they're trying to abuse the justice system to do everything they can to prevent that from happening. That is the objective here. If his name were Donald Smith and he weren't running for president, this case would never have been brought. This is not a crime for any human being other than Donald J. Trump, and the reason it's a crime for him is this is a partisan Democrat DA who came into office saying, I'm going to get Donald Trump. I'm going to find something and prosecute him because I hate him, and I want to do everything I can to stop the American people from voting for him. And you know what that is called? That is an assault on democracy, a phrase right. The Democrats love to say, but it is in fact what they are doing, and they're engaged in Freudian projection.
And so finally, Senator, you're right. CNN refused to cover the unrest right outside their doors in the middle of the street the other night, yeah, that Met Gala. But this Colombian janitor, that was kept against his will when the Hamilton building was taken over, is finally speaking out. Everyone said it didn't happen. Well, they haven't met Mario Torres. This is what he told the Free Press, cut 38.
I remember looking up and I noticed that the cameras were covered. How did they get up there? That's not like 10 feet. You know, you can't give somebody a boot. Like, these guys were pros. I'm sorry. You're not going to get 20 feet in the air to cover a camera. You know, how did he do that? I don't know. And how did they know they were there? And the vending machines, how did they know this was definitely planned? I thought they stormed into all the buildings, and it was until I got out that I realized that they targeted Hamilton.
And they did. And he went on, talked about the terror. He doesn't want to go back to campus. So these are professionals, Senator. That's another reason it's got to be investigated. Yep. Final thought?
Well, the Wall Street Journal reported this weekend that the anti-Israel, anti-Semitic protesters had trained for months, that it had been a systematic training. You know, it's very much like how the Hamas terrorists on October 7th trained for months to carry out this attack. This was a planned attack, and it was a funded attack, and it was funded by Joe Biden and the Democrats' biggest donors. So when people say, gosh, are Democrats unhappy that this is happening? No, it is all part of the same team. The same people who are paying for Joe Biden's campaign are paying for these anti-Israel protests. The objectives are the same.
Gotcha.
They want to tear down Israel, and they want to tear down America.
Senator Ted Cruz, looking for 6 more years in the Senate. Thanks so much, Senator. Good luck with your podcast today, and help him out as he tries to get reelected. Brian Kilmeade Show, back with your calls in a moment.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we're back just for 90 seconds. Just quick look. You know, we've been doing this thing. Everyone's focusing on our history. Everyone's running from our past. I kind of take on the war on history on stage. We bring back great moments in our past in a fun way. I also am able to use all my books, Teddy and Booker T and President Freedom Fighter, Thomas Jefferson, the Tripoli Pirates, George Washington's Secret Six, and Sam Houston, the Alamo Avengers, and able to move through time in our history. I'm going to be on stage again with this show. I think you're going to love it over in Indianapolis. Go to BrianKilmeade.com June 27th. And then be the following week towards the end of the month in East Stroudsburg on the 28th of July. So just go get tickets, and there's VIP opportunities. We get to hang out before and discuss what's going on in the news at that time as the conventions are just on the precipice of one or on the aftermath of the other, looking forward to the other. So that's a chance to meet you guys in person. Had a great time in Henderson, Nevada. Everyone at KDON helped spread that word, and hope to see you all in person too. Keep it here, BrianKilmeade.com. Also, if you have any of my books, you ever want them autographed, especially for Mother's Day, Father's Day, it comes to me, and I'll be able to send them out to you. So keep it here, Brian Kilmeade Show.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We come to you from New York City, the site of most of the campus unrest around the country. I mean, look, it's in 27 states. I get it. But if you talk about a place that's the epicenter of it, it's really right here. Think about NYU, Parsons School of Design. They broke up FIT. We have Columbia University, obviously, now Hunter. I mean, that's just off the top of my head. If you have a university, you have some type of unrest. What an embarrassment. Also, I have some quick news that just broke. It looks like the Fulton County is going to revisit whether Fannie Willis should stay on the Donald Trump case. That, at the very least, gives it more of a delay. And if she's pulled off, some other prosecutor's got to get it. And they also have to assess if it leaves Fulton County, is it worth it? Bottom line, delay. Bottom line, with the documents case, delay. No date set. It was supposed to be May 20th. They said we can't do it. Too much to look at. The Trump team says, I don't even know. I can't even get to that. We're in the middle of another case, so there's no date set. Get it to September, and they're not going to try it, and the president's just got to go ahead and win. Rich Lowry standing by. Johan Hari is going to be with us shortly. He wrote a book about the issue that probably everybody's talking about outside politics, and that is Ozempic, magic pill, the extraordinary benefits and disturbing risks of the new weight loss drug. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Well, I think the Department of Justice needs to investigate where the money is coming from. Donald Trump were president of the United States. His attorney general would be all over this. These college presidents would be under the gun to stop this crap.
Yep. Investigate and crush. That's the call from Congress and me to try and end the anti-Israel, anti-Jew hatred nationwide, especially on college campuses. This is well financed by anti-American forces, has to be stopped.
Number two.
We've seen a ferocious surge of anti-Semitism in America and around the world. On college campuses, Jewish students blocked, harassed, attacked. Too many people denying, downplaying, rationalizing, ignoring.
That is President Biden yesterday. It was a good speech. It was against anti-Semitism. It's strong. But his action with Israel are weak and disturbing and unacceptable. He's withholding arms that our Congress has given, earmarked, paid for, sent, and shipped to Israel because he doesn't like the way they're conducting this war. Not okay.
Number one.
But the cross-exam, boy. Her responses were disastrous. I mean, do you hate Donald Trump? Yes, of course she does. That's a big deal. When the witness hates the person whose liberty is at stake, that's a big damn deal.
Eli Honig of CNN telling what we all know, and he's the expert. Train wreck time at Trump trial. Classless, unhinged, unbalanced porn actress. Wild testimony on the stand Tuesday, and it could cost the prosecution dearly. I thought this was about campaign payments, right? We all heard about X-rated action instead. Even the judge sided with the defense to a degree as Trump gets a major win with the documents case thanks to a Miami judge. And we'll discuss that with Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, author of The Case for Nationalism. Rich, first off, your reaction to the fact is the Georgia ruling, they're going to reevaluate whether Fannie Willis stays on the case. But at the very least, this is a delay.
Yeah, I mean, it looks as though everything could be off except for this travesty of a case in New York City. We'll see. You know, the J6 is still a possibility, depending on what the Supreme Court does, but doesn't look that likely. So the major across-the-board effort from Democrats to get him tried as many times as possible and tied up, basically the – I mean, if he did all these trials, it'd be the entire election season, right? He'd be doing nothing but sitting in courtrooms. It may just be this New York City case, which is a disgrace and a travesty, but, you know, they very well could convict him.
That is true. The other thing I've got to ask you about is the judge in Miami said, I'm going to delay this. There's so many motions here. Obviously, the Trump team is caught up in it. Clearly, they got to get the highest security clearance in order to look at the documents through the case. And then the Trump team filed a grievance against the FBI by their handling of the documents.
Yeah, you know, who's on Fox talks about one case he had dealing with classified material, and I'm messing up the details slightly, but you get the point. And there was like a note card worth of classified material that it took like 3 months of argument just to have all sides agree how it's going to be handled and come up with the procedure. So there's just no way this one ever was going to happen before the election. I mean, maybe if Smith tried to radically simplify it and just go on his obstruction charges, but he hasn't shown any inclination to do it. So this one never seemed likely to happen. It doesn't look like it will.
So I want to talk about what's taking place. Today's an off day. Thursday, Friday won't be. Yesterday, Stormy Daniels, and she'll return on Thursday, took the stand. And they got, besides Michael Cohen, I don't know who else sensationalistic they could bring up. They had Hope Hicks last week. They could put Karen McDougal, but a lot of people say it's irrelevant. They want to try to show that the president used personal campaign funds to get hush money in order to have election interference back in 2016. So that is a difficult thing to prove, especially when you have to put up the right people and put this puzzle together. Stormy Daniels just made contradictory statements on the stand, talked about how she signed documents that said that and nothing happened between them. She did in 2012, 2014, too. And that was part of her agreement. And we don't know what to believe now. Then we find out that they give the unnecessary details about what they say happened between them. And it's the cover of the New York Post that says, this is Lewinsky-like. And when happened with Lewinsky, as Republicans remember, when they made all these salacious claims and you know, had Bill Clinton with denials, his ratings went up.
It backfired. But, I mean, the fundamental point is this is supposed to be the supposed crime, the central crime here is supposed to be how this payment was. Does nothing about that. Nothing. She has zero knowledge of that. So the only reason to put her on the stand is to create the salacious, detrimental information that the judge himself thinks now shouldn't have been the jury shouldn't have heard. But
so CNN's making a living.
It makes zero sense.
Right. CNN's making a living with literally an 8-person panel. 8 people just talking about this trial.
So that was the jury in itself.
Right. So, Rich, the crazy thing is outside their doors, there's wild protests at the Met Gala at Columbia. They're not even covering it. They're covering a trial that we can't even see. We have a sketch artist bring it to life. So Paula Reed, the CNN chief legal correspondent, even had to call it as she saw it. Cut five.
Right off the bat, Susan Nicholas got Stormy Daniels to admit that she hates Trump. She says, yes, I hate him. They point out the fact that Stormy Daniels has said publicly that she would, quote, dance if Trump went to jail. Stormy Daniels says, I don't owe him expletive, and I'll never give that orange turd a dime. Now, Daniels said that this tweet is in retaliation for what he says about her. Now, this is when it got really heated, because Nicholas confirms, you call him names all the time. And Daniels starts to sort of yell, saying, yes, because he made fun of me first. I mean, this is devolving pretty quickly, right? This is pretty toddler-esque conduct and lack of accountability. But what the defense is very effectively getting at is Daniels' disdain for the defendant. So this so far has been a very effective and dramatic cross and appears to continuing to become even more dramatic.
Yeah, so what were they thinking? Evidently, they actually did work with Stormy Daniels on her testimony. Prior to this, they work with her. She admitted it. Yeah, I've been coached. You've been coached, and you still screwed up. So Rich Lowry, who just played Paula Reed, coming out and saying that Stormy Daniels blowing up and saying how much she likes Trump, hates Trump, is really detrimental to everything she says, along with admitting that she's not going to pay the fines that a court ordered her to pay back to Trump for defamation. So she shows a disdain for the court. She shows a personal agenda, and she also admits she was being coached. Final thought here before we move on and talk about Joe Biden.
Well, she's just not a very credible witness, right? And maybe slightly more credible than Michael Cohen, but he's going to be the star of star witnesses and has perjured himself repeatedly. So there'll be more where that came from.
All right, we'll see what happens, because they say if Trump is convicted, he'll lose about 4% of the vote. He can't lose any. Neither can Joe Biden. You wrote a column today that says President Biden's biggest problem is that his presidency is an utter failure. If you look at the border, you look at the economy, you look at foreign policy, you look at energy, you look at everything, please tell me where he's excelling, except for a green agenda that Americans don't want.
Yeah, so he punched above his weight legislatively. There's no doubt about that. But people either don't care about it. You know, people like bridges fine, right? But is it really a voting issue in a presidential election? And the green agenda has major downsides. And the spending has played a role in the inflation, which is the factor that's fundamentally undermining Biden's economic legacy and standing. But just the results have been bad, whether it's the Afghan pullout or it's the border or what's happening now around the world. And this is just the key thing. You ask people, did Trump do a good job as president? More than 50% say, yeah. You ask them, is Joe Biden doing a good job? And more than 50% say no. So they're going to try to get around that, you know, with abortion and Trump's alleged threat to democracy and Stormy Daniels and all the rest of it. But that just seems to me Biden is trailing on the core consideration. Are you doing a good job? And they're going to try to use this peripheral stuff to dirty up Trump and make him unacceptable. And, you know, that might work. But you'd rather have the core strength that Trump does rather than the peripheral issues that Biden does.
So, Rich, remember when they took an inexperienced person and made him president, they said it was going to be chaos. He's not going to have any relationship, not instincts. He's not going to know what to do. If this was happening during Trump's first term, they would say this is an example of a guy who doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah,
everything he touches is falling apart. Eastern Europe is at war. The Middle East is on fire like no time we ever seen in our lifetime. China's on the march, rattling our allies, Japan and the Philippines, and the border's never been more broken, and our immigration laws are being ignored. I mean, this is just chaos everywhere. Here's what Jen Psaki says. I want you to get this. This is what she says is the reason why Trump is popular with Republicans, who have pretty much united around him despite everything on January 6th, the controversial with all Russia, a tough primary. This is what she said. Cut 27.
I think there's two categories. I mean, there's obviously the Tim Scott category, as you said. That's embarrassing to watch. Cringy. I've watched it many times. I think many of them want to be close to power. They also assume or have this thought in their mind that maybe Donald Trump will go away. Maybe he'll go to jail. Maybe he will die, not to be too morbid, but maybe, I mean, he's not a young man. Who knows what's in their minds? They think maybe I will be behind the Oval Office. Maybe I will be in the Oval Office.
Really? So they're staying with Trump because they hope he'll die.
I, have not had anyone say, you know, they think so-and-so wants to be Veep because they think Trump's going to die. You know, they think he's going to win and they'll be Veep. That's the basic play. And maybe Republicans are a little too over-optimistic. You know, this is a close race and this could still go either way. But they think he's going to win. And they don't think he's at death's door. They think that about Joe Biden.
I just thought that there's a lot of people, like, for example, if Joe Biden was using experience and instinct, he would have been vehemently against the unrest on campus, vehemently, yeah, naturally against anti-Semitism, speaking out wherever it goes and making sure that if you had a disagreement with Israel, it was rumored. A good reporter might have it, let alone the Secretary of State who's demanding they don't go into Rafah and finish off Hamas. And if you want an instinctive Democratic legislator, it is John Fetterman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, think about what he's been saying without any notes, grabs his hoodie, goes out there coming off a stroke. And this is what he said about Donald Trump's chances in Pennsylvania. Cut 28.
You know, I've been having that kind of a conversation now since 2016. You know, I identified that there is a risk here that Trump can actually win. And most people didn't thought that it was going to be a joke. And I'm like, no. It's, I spent too much time in across the state and I realized that something is happening. And now 24, it's going to be very competitive. It's going to be close. Always has been, always will be. And I do believe Joe Biden is going to win. But anyone that takes Trump seriously do that at their own peril. He has a connection in Pennsylvania, and we have to make sure that we do whatever we can.
So he gets it. He said any guy that can go into Pennsylvania and get 25,000 people has got his attention. It's like he's just a practical guy. When it comes to anti-Semitism, it's got to stop now. He doesn't believe these kids even know what they're talking about. And when it comes to Israel, you got to support them. It's blame Hamas. So,
yeah.
I mean, how could a guy in a hoodie coming off a stroke figure that out, and another guy who's been doing this for 50 years not?
Yeah, he's totally transformed his image, Fetterman. Not really by changing on the substance, you know, his position on Social Security, whatever it is, same as it's always been, but just saying common sense things in some pungent ways about issues that really matter to people and punch through. And if Biden just had, you know, a 50% John Fetterman instinct, he'd be in much better shape because he would have done something about the border, right? He wouldn't be trying to ditch Israel. He wouldn't be pandering to these protesters. And he could still be in favor of all the spending and all the rest of it, a semi-socialist agenda. But people say, oh, you know, he gets it, or he's not beholden to the left, or he's not weak. And they don't think any of those things now.
Well, so, Rich, just looking past Trump for just a quick second, with all your knowledge, do you think there's going to be a time when the next two candidates who pop up, they're going to be younger, obviously. Number two, do you think they might be center right and center left? Do you think there's a sense among the American people they need a logic and less blatant idealism?
I don't know. You know, I was so surprised by Trump's rise, obviously, in 2016. I hesitate to make any prediction about what it's going to be like when he's gone. And he's just so utterly dominant at the moment and is such a huge figure in terms of politics, media, culture. And now it's a little difficult to imagine, like, what it would be like if he disappeared, right? In 2016, it was hard to imagine what it would be like if he took over. Now he's had such a grip for so long, it's really hard to imagine. So I just hesitate to predict.
Wow. Okay. You know enough to know you don't know. That's so interesting.
Exactly.
All right, Rich.
At least some of the time.
Pick up National Review. Rich Lowry, always great. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks, Brian.
All right. Listen, I see you up there. I see you up there in Waterbury. I see you in Long Island, Daytona. We're going to get to all your calls in just a moment. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Then the biggest story outside politics in this country is the Ozempic and the other pills that lose weight. They do work. Is there an after effect? Johann Hari wrote a book about it called The Magic Pill. He is going to be in studio. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. We got a couple of minutes here. Let's go. Wow, look at these lines. Let's go out to Bill on WABC. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Brian. How you doing, Brian?
Good. What's on your mind?
You know, I'll tell you, I'm really not happy with the way the Biden administration is hiding Joe Biden. You know, I really think it's sad that we don't have access to
him
And it's just, you know, unreal. It's just this,
Bill, doesn't it show you he can't do the job? Doesn't it show you he can't do the job? It's not so much he's doing a bet, he can't do it.
No, he can't do it. And if people look at him, they will see he's a frail old man. He's not like Trump. He's not energetic. He has no spunk. I mean, the guy can't even speak. He mumbles when he speaks. I mean, it's really sad that they're putting him out there for us.
I know.
It's disgusting.
Steve, WABC in Florida. Steve, real quick.
Okay, here it is. I have small following, okay? I'm very little bit on the internet. I love Fox. I love WABC. Here's the picture. Everybody loves and hates the MAGA hat. Everybody loves and hates the red beret. They're both worldwide known, worldwide, courtesy with a vice president. They're both the hardest working people in America. They're both fighting for the same thing. Freedom, justice. Curtis Sliwa was a never Trumpster. He's changed his mind now. Now he knows the truth. I think this needs to get out to Donald Trump.
All right. There's a lot of people in New York that see what's going on here and are going into the Trump category. This is a joke, this court case.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. We're going to put politics on hold for a second. We are following what's going on. We do know a couple of things that are happening. First off, if you're just tuning in, it looks like the Fulton County Court is going to entertain kicking Fani Willis off the case. The Trump team said, we have to look at this. Why is she still on the case? Look at her ethics. Look at her values. Look at how the $1 million that are missing in her miscellaneous fund. And they said, okay, we'll revisit it. What does it mean? Delay. What does it mean in the documents case? Because they said there's so many petitions, so many motions. The Eileen Cannon, the judge, says, I need more time. We're not doing this in May. We're going to maybe look to do it in July. But right now we're in delay. And we know about the immunity case that the Supreme Court is seeing. They're going to take a look and find out what the president, if he is at all immune from any type of criminal activity and criminal charges. So we're following that story. Along with the mayor of New York City, has put $5,000 of his own money up to find out any information that could lead to information on who defiled the World War One memorial in the unrest at the Met Gala after the Met Gala on Monday night. With me right now, though, in studio, back with us for a different reason, Johan Hari, New York Times bestselling author. Remember Stolen Focus? Well, now he's got a brand new book out. It's something that I know you, if you're not using it personally, you've talked about it. It's called Magic Pill, The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs. Johan, welcome.
Hey, Brian. Great to be back.
First off, I got a notice from you. You have lost weight. Is that what prompted the writing of this book? Did you use Ozempic?
Yeah, it was a mixture of things, really. The first time I learned about Ozempic, I remember just feeling so kind of torn because part of me thought, wow, this is going to be huge and there's going to be great health benefits to this, right? I'm older now than my grandfather ever got to be because he died of a heart attack when he was 44.
He wasn't in good shape?
No. And we know that obesity makes a huge array of problems, much more likely. It's actually 200 diseases and complications are made more likely by being obese. And I learned that these drugs cause you to lose, on average, 15% of your body weight in a year. In fact, for the next in this group of drugs, which will be available soon, you lose 24% of your body weight in a year on average. And I knew, okay, so if there's a drug that really can hugely reduce or reverse obesity, that's going to have some obvious benefits. But I also thought, wait a minute. I've seen this story before, right? You'll remember about every 20 years, we're always told, you know, there's a new miracle diet drug that's been discovered.
Dexatrim.
Exactly. We could list them, right, from our lifetimes. It's going to save us all. They always discover it has some horrendous side effect. They have to pull it from the market, leaving a trail of broken people in its wake. So I wanted to understand, okay, what's going on here? What are these drugs? What will they mean for all of us? So I started taking them, and I went on this big journey all over the world.
But were you doing it because you wanted to write the book, or were you doing it for Johan to be healthier?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, and I went on this big journey all over the world, from Iceland to Minneapolis to Japan, to interview the leading experts, the biggest critics of the drugs, the biggest defenders of the drugs. And what I learned is kind of, it's complicated. There are really big benefits to these drugs for your health. And there are 12 really quite big risks associated with these drugs. And I think everyone out there, and also there's a lot of people need to be prepared for what will happen to you if you take these drugs that I go through in my book, Magic Pill. So I think we really need to take a beat to think carefully about the benefits, the risks, and the changes that are coming.
So let's, in the time we have, let's go through some of your extensive research. Number one, it's not just Ozempic. There are other drugs.
Exactly. Mounjaro, yeah.
Well, how many are there?
So there's lots.
How many
at the
did
moment.
You look at?
I looked at all the ones that are currently available.
So
in this class.
Mounjaro is big.
Exactly.
Right?
And Mounjaro gives you 21% body weight loss. And it's fascinating to look at how these drugs work. So if you ate something now, Brian, they all work on a similar mechanism. If you ate something now, your pancreas would produce a hormone called GLP-1. And it's basically, we know, that's just your body's natural signal going, hey, Brian, you've had enough, stop eating, right? But natural GLP-1 only stays in your system for a few minutes and then it's washed away. What these drugs do is they inject you with an artificial copy of GLP-1 that, instead of being washed away in a few minutes, stay in your system for a whole week. So it has this really weird experience. I'll never forget the second day I was taking Ozempic. I woke up, I was lying in bed, and I thought, oh, I feel something really weird here. What's going on? And I couldn't locate what it was in my body. And then I realized I'd woken up and I wasn't hungry. I don't remember that ever happening to me before. I used to wake up and be so hungry. And I went to this diner that I used to go to every morning, and I ordered what I used to order, which was every day for breakfast, I'm slightly embarrassed to say, which was a huge brown roll with loads of chicken and loads of mayo in it. And I had like 3-4 mouthfuls and I was just full. You feel very full very fast because they boost your GLP-1 levels so that you're basically starting at almost full. That's why I lost, 42 pounds in a year.
Is that what people describe when they get their stomach tied?
Exactly. I think you've gone to a really important thing, which is actually, if you want to understand the effects of these drugs, both the good and the bad, it helps to look at bariatric surgery, because up to now, it's been extremely hard to lose loads of weight and keep it off for the long term. Some people can do it just through willpower. If you can, do it that way, because then you don't get all these risks. But most people fail at that method. I had. So up to now, actually, the most reliable method has been bariatric surgery, things like stomach stapling. And if you look at bariatric surgery, we know a few things. Firstly, it's a horrible operation, right? But if you get through it, if you have this operation and these drugs are having a similar effect, we know that in the 7 years that follow, you are 56% less likely to die of a heart attack. You are 60% less likely to die of cancer. You are 92% less likely to die of diabetes-related causes. In fact, it's so good for your health, you're 40% less likely to die at all in those 7 years. So we know, sadly, obesity is catastrophic for your health. It's not the fault of people. We shouldn't stigmatize them. But it is catastrophic for your health. And if you can reverse it, it's a really good idea to do it. And these drugs do hugely reduce or reverse it, which is why when you take these drugs, you're 20% less likely to have a heart attack or stroke. But you can also begin to see some of the drawbacks when you look at the evidence from bariatric surgery that we know are also playing out with these drugs. I'll give you an example. It seems kind of shocking and weird at first. After you have bariatric surgery, even though your health gets so much better, you're 4 times more likely to commit suicide and actually a lot more likely to become depressed. I was thinking, huh, that's really weird. What's going on there? And I noticed when I took the drugs, for the first 6 months, I was in this kind of weird thing. I was getting what I wanted. I was losing loads of weight. Actually, I didn't feel better. If anything, I felt a little bit kind of muted. I thought, this is weird. What's going on here? And I think I began to understand it. There's a debate. This seems to be happening to lots of people. It's a debate about why. Some people think it's because the drugs primarily affect your brain. There's something going on in your brain. There probably is. But for me, I actually, and the bariatric surgery people, I think it was something much more basic. I had a real kind of realization about this. I was in Las Vegas. And I'm spending a lot of time there because I'm writing a book about some crimes that have been happening there. And I was researching the murder of someone I knew and loved. So it was really, you can imagine, rough. And I felt bad. And I went to this branch of KFC that I've been to 1,000 times. And I ordered what I would have ordered a year before, right? A big bucket of fried chicken. And I had one of the drumsticks and I suddenly thought, oh, I can't eat this, right? Like, you can't comfort eat when you're on these drugs. You can't overeat. You would vomit if you tried to. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm just going to have to feel bad, right? One of the things that's going on with these drugs, along with many positive things, is they interrupt your eating patterns, right? You can't eat the way you did before. Obviously, it brings lots of benefits, but also what that can do is bring to the surface a lot of the kind of underlying psychological reasons why you eat.
Why you eat.
Exactly.
Because people get satisfaction from eating. They look for something to look forward to. They enjoy eating. Maybe they don't love the fact that they're overweight, but that's something they enjoy doing.
I think there's
and now that's gone.
I think there's a few things. You're exactly right. One of them is just pleasure. Food is one of the great pleasures in life for most people, right? And for example, there's a brilliant British food critic called Jay Rayner who talked about he started taking Ozempic. He would go to the best restaurants and it would be like he just got nothing out of the food, right? That didn't actually happen to me, but a lot of people lose their pleasure in food. For me, I think it was something different. I realized ever since I was a kid, one of the ways I would calm myself down and kind of soothe my feelings was actually by overeating, by stuffing myself, right? And I couldn't do that anymore. So that's one of the 12 risks of the drugs that seem to be playing out that I write about in my book, Magic Pill, that I think we all need to be prepared for. Because, you know, this is blowing up. Right. 47% of Americans want to take these drugs. We really need to be aware. There's a very strong case for the drugs. If you have a BMI higher than 35, I would recommend them. I think the benefits outweigh the risks at that point. Because really what you've got to be constantly comparing is two things. The risk of continuing to be obese, which is really significant.
Okay, that's a big one.
And the risk of the drugs. And there's no like magic calculator.
So what are the downsides? Number one, I hear it's hard to get muscle tone back. Number two, it also you constantly feel a little sick, right? You feel a little nauseous.
So
the
first one is definitely right. For the second one, for nausea, so almost everyone feels nauseous at first. For me, it wasn't so bad. It was if I just randomly one day felt that nauseous, I wouldn't have like gone to bed or not gone to work. But it's unpleasant. But for most people, that goes away pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. There are some people it doesn't and they have to stop taking the drug. But the vast majority of people, like I've been on it a year and 4 months now, and I don't get nauseous at all. So, but there's some risks that I'm much more worried about. So, I mean, there's a lot that I'm worried about. There's some serious scientists who are concerned that it significantly increases your risk of thyroid cancer. The risk remains rare, but that does seem to be happening. Pregnant women, I'm really worried about this. We know that if you give these drugs to rats, they're much more likely to have fetuses with birth deformities. There are currently no studies on giving this to women.
Is it true they overcome, Ozempic overcomes the pill, the birth control pill?
I've not heard any research on that. But there's some that we also should be worried about in terms of, think about eating disorders, right? So we already have a huge number of young girls, it is overwhelmingly young girls, who have terrible eating disorders who are trying to starve themselves. I am really worried about those girls getting hold of these drugs because you can just amputate your appetite, right? So in the worst case scenario, we could have a kind of opioid-like death toll of young girls who shouldn't be getting these drugs, right? Obviously, this is not what they're for. They're for overweight or obese people to come down to a healthy weight, not for people who are already thin to come down to super
thin. And you're just assuming people, this is a prescription, isn't it?
So it's meant to be a prescription. This is one of the big problems.
But you can overcome the prescription by going to another country.
You don't have to go to another country. In practice, you are not eligible for these drugs. I can see looking at you, you should not be given them. But I guarantee you, your producer could line up now on Zoom an appointment for a doctor with you in half an hour and a doctor is meant to check your BMI on Zoom, but how much are they doing that? When I got these drugs in Vegas, I had already been using them in Britain. My BMI was too low to be given it. They didn't check. They didn't ask me. It's basically been given out to anyone. So we've got to tighten the rules around who gets it. But it's interesting because the book is called Magic Pill.
You said I'm right about muscle tone.
Yeah.
So what if you're working out at the same time? You're just not going to get the same response when you take the pill?
So when you lose weight in any way, through dieting or these drugs or anything else, you lose a lot of muscle mass, which is the total amount of soft tissue in your body. It's really important because muscle mass is what makes it possible for you to move. And as you age, depressingly from the age of 30 onwards, you lose muscle mass every year, right? The danger here, particularly for people who are using these drugs who were not fat at the start, who were already thin, is that you're going to go into the aging process with already low levels of muscle mass. You're not going to have much to lose. The problem with that is that won't show up now, 5 years, 10 years down the line. But when you're old, you're much more at risk of having a condition called sarcopenia, which is a terrible condition where basically you can't really get out of a chair on your own. You can't walk up the stairs.
Wow.
So we could be setting up. This would mostly not be the case for overweight people, but for people who are taking it who are not overweight, there's a real risk we're setting in place a time bomb, and there's a few different time bombs we could be putting in place.
Right. Let me just hold that thought so we have some moment. I won't take up too much. I have one huge segment and one small. We'll have more with Johann Haar. He's got a brand new book out called Magic Pill. Certainly be a bestseller. He is a multiple bestseller. The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs. Don't move.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Name of the book is The Magic is Magic Pill. Johann Hari in the studio guests. We have a few more minutes. The extraordinary benefits and disturbing risks of the new weight loss drugs. You said you took Ozempic. You're taking Ozempic?
Yeah.
You take a shoot every day?
No, it's once a week.
Once a week. So at which time you said your appetite was curtailed, but you also mentioned some of the good part is you lose the weight. You're no longer anyone who takes it is no longer obese. You lost 42 pounds. So people listening right now, if they read Magic Pill, will they be more or less likely to do what you did?
I think what they'd have to do is go down the list of the risks of obesity that I talk about in the book and the 12 big risks of the drugs and figure out which of these are likely to apply to me. So different people have different – I think there's no like blanket one-size-fits-all policy. Generally, though, I would say if you have a BMI higher than 35, so you're severely obese, on balance, unless you have thyroid cancer in your family or you're trying to get pregnant – I would say you should probably take the drugs because the benefits will outweigh the risks. If your BMI is lower than 27, I would say don't take them because you're taking all the risks for no benefit, right? Or only an aesthetic benefit. But I do think we need to think about these drugs in a complicated and truthful way. We also need to understand how we even got here, Brian, right? You and I were talking about this off air, but obesity has exploded in our lifetimes, right? We're a similar age. Anyone who Googles a photo of a beach in this country in, say, 1979... it's kind of shocking, right? Everyone looks thin to us. You're like, where's everyone else? And we know why obesity blew up. It blows up everywhere where there's one change. It's where people move from mostly eating fresh whole foods they prepared on the day to mostly eating processed foods, which are built out of factories, built out of chemicals in factories. It turns out that food affects us in a completely different way, which is what set us up for these drugs. So these foods undermine our ability to ever feel full. And what the drugs do is they give you back your feeling of being full, but at a risk, right? And there's an experiment that really helped me to understand this, done by a scientist here in New York called Professor Paul Kenny. He got a load of rats and he raised them in a cage. And all they had to eat was the kind of healthy whole foods that rats grew up with for thousands of years. And when that's all they had, they would eat when they were hungry and then they would just stop. They seemed to know naturally, oh, I've had enough now. So they never became fat. Then he introduced them to like the American diet, right? He got a load of Snickers bars and fried bacon and cheesecake, and he put it alongside the healthy food. And the rats went crazy for the healthy, cheesecake and the other food, right? They would literally dive into the cheesecake and eat their way out. And this kind of natural ability to know how to stop that they used to have disappeared. They all became really obese, right? And this is happening to us, right? The food environment we live in, if you're sitting there, you know, when I was fat, I felt like such a failure. And there was definitely an element of willpower that is real. But I also realize now I was a totally typical product of our times. The food we eat is totally undermining our ability to ever feel full and to know when to stop. And what these drugs do is they give you back that feeling of being full.
How long are you nauseous for? And your digestive system, how long is it affected?
So for me, I was nauseous. So you inject once a week and I was nauseous the next day for about 3 or 4 months. And it's quite unpleasant. I don't want to undersell that. And for some people, it's like horrifying and they have to stop. I also got constipation. Sorry, it's an unpleasant thing to mention on the radio. And I had that for maybe 3 or 4 months. But for most people, those common side effects go away.
What did it do for your self-esteem?
I felt much better.
Right now, you feel better than a year ago?
Much, much better. People treat you differently. Now, it shouldn't be like that, but we've got to level with people. People treat you better. You feel better. Partly that's health, right? You feel healthier. You're not, you don't get tired so much. But there's definitely a kind of self-esteem.
Why'd you say magic pill? Why magic?
I think there's three ways these drugs could be magic. The first is they could just solve the problem, right? And there are days it feels like that. My whole life, Brian, I've been addicted to junk food. Now I inject myself once a week in the leg. That's all gone away. It feels like magic. The second way is much more disturbing. It could be like a magic trick. It could be like a conjurer who shows you like a card trick while picking your pocket. It could be the risks outweigh the benefits. I don't rule that out. The third way it could be magic, I actually think is the most likely. Think about the stories of magic we grew up with, like Aladdin, right? You find the lamp, you get your wish, and the wish comes true, but never quite in the way you expected, right? I think it's most like that.
Johann, thank you.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest minutes of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm looking at, like, every screen, and there's so much going on today. First off, we got latest on the court cases. We also have there's some movement there on some of the cases not involved in New York City. And then we have some of the unrest that's taking place. I didn't really cover this yet today, and that is George Washington University embarrassed the country by letting that Palestinian garb hang over George Washington's face on the statue of GWU. They let it stay there for 2.5 weeks. I don't understand why. I don't understand why the D.C. police can turn down the management and the president of George Washington University when they said they need help. They said, we do not want to clear the encampments. We don't like the look. I never heard of that before, if that is indeed the case. The mayor met this morning of D.C., and now she's on Capitol Hill. We're going to bring you someone with how she explains how she lets all this unrest take place. But all hell is breaking loose in Washington anyway. So we'll get to some of that. Just real quick on the Georgia case. It looks like the Georgia case, remember the local one, Fulton County, they are revisiting and taking up the petition of offered I guess the protests of the Trump camp who came out and said there's no way Fani Willis should be on this case. The money that's been spent, that's not been accounted for, the way she acted with Nathan Wade, her boyfriend, giving him the prominent position, there's no way after the way she acted and she testified that she should be in control of this case against the former president of the United States. And guess what? They said, you're right, we're going to take another look at it. More delay. So that's important. We'll tell you what's happening. Now let's bring in a very important guest. Julia Steinberg is with us, and she is a student at Stanford Review. She wrote an article about the Stanford protesters collaborating with the Marxist-Leninist organization. We have not heard a lot about what's going on at Stanford. Julia, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Can you educate me? I've been so caught up with USC and UCLA and Santa Cruz. I have not heard much about how Stanford's handling this. What have you seen?
I think I'm very lucky to be at Stanford, obviously because it's a great school, but just because I don't think things have been as bad as they have been at other universities. And I think that's because Stanford maintains a sort of capitalist mindset. They're on the same day that the encampments were recently reestablished, Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, came to speak. And the line for that was like 6 times bigger than the protest that day. I think politics at Stanford are opt-in and not opt-out. However, I think that Stanford, on October 7th, we saw banners celebrating the horrific invasion of Israel. And since then, we had the sort of original sit-in as well. So I think there is a small but very vocal group of anti-Israel protesters on this campus. And like university administrators at so many other schools, the university is unwilling to exert really its authority and upkeeping its policies, which ban public camping.
Why is that? I mean, why would people have a proclivity in a state like yours, who are the elite of the elite, who have a great opportunity for education? Why do they not like the form of government they're in?
I think a lot of it is guilt. I think we see, and this is something I sort of am familiar with. I was raised in Los Angeles. I went to a private school, and I was very liberal, if not like leftist, for a lot of my sort of high school years. And I think a lot of that was guilt, that I was in such a fantastic position to sort of go on and, you know, do anything I really wanted to do. And instead of being grateful for my family for working hard to get where I was, I felt that it was unfair that they had worked so hard because I felt so guilty for being born in a white upper class family. And I think these are not all, but many of the protesters have a similar background where they feel guilty about being byproducts of American excellence.
So interesting, because when they want to make a stand, why wouldn't it be with the Uyghurs, the Muslim Uyghurs in China, where they're kept really in concentration camps? Why were they not upset that the barrel bombs were dropping on innocent Syrians by the Russians in Syria? Why do they just take a stand against Israel? Obviously, traditionally, we've been their number one defender. And now all of a sudden we have people describing Palestinians as, the people that we should be defending. And Hamas is the one that's the elected form of government. You write the PSL Bay Arena, Stanford Students for Justice posted on April 27th, I Kifa wearing woman tour the sit-in. You said the vibes are amazing today after welcoming to the People's University. So they're making all types of communist references.
Yeah, it's a bit bizarre. There's actually a library that they set up, and I walked by. It's funny. There's like a little border that they've set up around the sit-in because, of course, you know, anarcho-communists, the first thing they do when they establish these sit-ins is put up a border and have security guards wearing yellow vests they got off of Amazon. But in this bookshelf is like, you know, all the sort of seminal Marxist-Leninist texts. It's, I think that for a lot of people in the sit-in or who are part of the anti-Israel protests, a lot of it is motivated by just broader leftist politics. It doesn't matter that the government of Gaza, the elected government of Gaza, is like right-wing and Islamic. It doesn't matter that, for example, it's like the Queers for Palestine movement, I think, is the number one example of this. It doesn't matter that it's ideologically inconsistent because it's a rebellion against sort of the West, which they see as evil.
And do you see formal organizations like Marxist organizations on campus?
There's a flyering outside of the sit-in a few days ago. And, you know, we have sort of all people of all sorts of political persuasions on campus in White Plaza, which I think is generally good. But there are people who are invited to the sit-in on this Instagram account from the Party of Socialism and Liberation, which is pro-China, pro-North Korea even, pro-Syria. And they were saying, come in, come in, come in. And walking past White Plaza for the past few days, you know, on my way to class on the western part of campus, it's interesting because I see a lot of people who are not Stanford students who are just sort of hanging around. And Stanford's an open campus. They have every right to do that. But, for example, last night we sort of found out that the viral picture of a man on Stanford's campus who was wearing a Hamas headband was not a Stanford student. He was just some random guy who showed up to campus.
Right. That picture is circulating everywhere. He looks like he's a Hamas soldier sitting in Stanford campus. Julia Steinberger, guest. She is a Stanford. She is a Stanford student, student of Stanford Review, and wrote a column called "Stanford Protesters Collaborate with the Marxist-Leninist Organization." That's really what the focus of this is. What do you want people to know about this, and what do you think? What do you think we can do about this?
I think that the biggest thing people can do, especially students on college campuses, young people, is to not sit passively by while universities sort of cower to anti-Israel and even anti-American protesters. I think the biggest thing to do is make sure that you let administrators know, you let faculty at universities know that there are students or young people who are willing to stand up for American values and who are willing to fight against the sort of leftist invasion of college campuses. I think that a lot of young people I talk to, even some of my friends, are like, oh, the situation is hopeless. There's sort of no way to do this. But I think just by raising even attention, just documenting what you see, taking pictures of the sit-in, or even just taking pictures of, you know, the syllabi that they give you in class, I think that can go a long way of sort of exposing the institutional rot and changing things for the better.
Julia, last question about the faculty. What percentage of the faculty in and out of political division, history, and others are leftists, are radical, and are looking to radicalize students, like we've seen so many join in on campus at the University of North Carolina. We see they refuse to do final grades because they don't like the breaking up of the encampment. I see it at NYU. I see it at the new school here. I see it in Columbia. How much of the UCLA, how much of the faculty agree with the leftist agenda, roughly?
I think it's definitely different in different departments. I study comparative literature, which maybe is my mistake because it's a pretty leftist department, though the professors I've taken classes with are either sort of classical liberals who believe in free speech or are more right-leaning. But I've heard so many stories of students, and I've also felt this myself, who even before October 7th felt afraid to sort of speak up in class and disagree because they thought they would be penalized. So I think that if you're going to be an engineering student, you're not going to have to worry about your problem set being sort of graded down because you didn't write Free Palestine at the top of it. But for a lot of students in the humanities, what we're taught is this critical, like critical theory, critical race theory, Frantz Fanon, who's sort of the author who I think most defines a lot of this movement, this sort of anti-colonial violence is okay, that sort of idea. I've read him in three classes.
Wow. All right. So what do you want to do long-term, Julia?
I plan on going into journalism.
Got it. And how close are you to graduating?
I'm a year and 5 weeks away.
All right.
So I still have some.
And you're doing the best thing. You got samples out there so people know how talented you are. And, of course, coming out of Stanford, when people understand that you're not indoctrinated, I think it'll really help. Julia, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. I'll get back to you. We'll find a lot of the breaking news. Also, I should add that we've held back weapon systems, sales, deliveries to Israel, but it has not stopped them moving on Rafah. We'll discuss that. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's absurd, Brian, and it's just another example where President Joe Biden has failed to support our most precious ally, Israel. Congress passed supplemental funding and military aid to Israel, and it is outrageous and is not complying with congressional intent, the fact that the Biden administration is holding these back. This is as Israel is, you know, suffered its bloodiest day since the Holocaust with the terrorist attack on October 7th. They're fighting for their very existence. So House Republicans are pushing back, both in our oversight capacity, as well as conversations between the Speaker of the House and the President of the United States about how this is absolutely unacceptable.
And what Elise Stefanik told me today on Fox and Friends is that it's unbelievable that you would hold back weapon systems to a country at war, surrounded by enemies, Hezbollah, the Houthi rebels, Hamas, as well as the overwhelming number, the overwhelming of which are financed by Iran, as you know, 300 rockets sent their direction. So this is what they halted shipments on as of April. We have paused shipment of weapons last week of 1,800, 2,000-pound bombs, 1,700, 500-pound bombs, especially focused on the 2,000-pound bombs and the impact they could have on a dense urban setting, as they've seen in parts of Gaza. Listen, if you ask them how the Rafah campaign is going to be carried out, it's not with 2,000-pound bombs. What Trey Yinks told us yesterday, and when he went over again today, he's our great correspondent there. They would do that for Hezbollah. Hezbollah has been rocketing them regularly, including yesterday, and Israel just hit back today. So they need those bombs for that moment. It's just incredible. This administration half-asses everything. Ukraine. Yeah, we're going to defend Ukraine. Well, there's going to be an invasion. There's going to be an invasion. They have an invasion, and they quickly offer Zelensky a ride out. When Kyiv holds out, it becomes, okay, we'll get you weapons. What are you going to get us? Get us some planes. Get us some Patriots. No and no. We're just going to give you ammo. Okay. We end up getting Patriots. We end up giving them HIMARS. We ended up eventually getting them F-15s. We end up giving them Abrams tanks. All slow walking. Why? They don't want to be too provocative on the Russians. The Russians come in with a hammer, and we're trying to finesse our way to helping our ally. In comes Hamas with a hammer. Massacres innocent people. Go easy on the retaliation. We don't want to alienate the whole world. Instead of saying it's Hamas's problem, not ours. They have 70% of the support of the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians, sadly, a lot of innocent people are dying, too many, but it's not the intention. And if you have a disagreement, you're supposed to keep it behind closed doors. That doesn't seem to happen. And that's what Elise Stefanik was referring to. Why would you slow walk them? They're the good guys in this situation. And the guy that does understand that is Senator Fetterman. He came out with Brett yesterday and just started talking about what's at stake here with Israel and why more people aren't sticking up for him and how these protests make no sense. Here it is, cut 16.
Does it bother you that some of the people funding some of these protests are also some of
the president's biggest donors.
I don't really care who's funding it. It's just like, but it's the Jewish Voice for Peace and the other ones, they try to pretend that they're like some grassroots kind of thing, and it's not. You know, they're paid, and I have said this. I don't care if you're a protester, paid or not. You know, if you've got to protest anything, you should be protesting against Hamas and demanding that they take the ceasefire, or they can just send all these hostages back home. And that's very clear. They've been showing up in my office in Philadelphia back in, I think, October, and it's not grassroots. It's just paid kinds of agitation.
Right, and people see behind it, but we need an investigation of it. For Ari Fleischer, he doesn't get it. It's very easy to back Israel. Forget those people protesting on college campuses. They're never going to vote for Republicans anyway, and they're probably not going to. They're probably going to have no choice but to vote for Joe Biden or maybe stay home. But at least you know if you're Joe Biden, you're doing the right thing. Let the chips fall where they may. And you know what? If you get people the weapons they need right now, this could end quickly, and maybe people could forget about it by November if you're Joe Biden. Listen to Ari Fleischer, Cut 21.
You know, Ronald Reagan famously said peace through strength, and Joe Biden is proving that weakness gets you the opposite. And that's what we see. Every time you push against Joe Biden, he yields. And remember, when Joe Biden says don't, by the way, when he said don't invade Ukraine, don't to Iran fire missiles at Israel, everybody does it anyway. So when Joe Biden gives a speech in which he mouths the right words about anti-Semitism, I'm glad he said that, does it really matter? Is he going to deter anybody's behavior?
No. Gary in Daytona. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Brian. Good morning. Just two really quick comments and can't wait to hear if you can give your take on them. Number one, the Jewish students around the country, they have to find the best law firms. There's not a chance in the world. You have to sue the universities. They don't have any bonds or any insurance on violating civil rights. And just like Nicholas Sandman, it will get their attention, even if it takes 2 or 3 years. The other point I was going to make, you can comment on, is everywhere these protesters go, they make it look like Eagle Pass. The trash, the garbage. The last thing I want to hear them ever complain about is the environment and what damage we're doing.
I hear you, especially with when it comes to building the wall. Absolutely. See what's happening on the other side. And keep in mind, there are people that are going to be suing the university, like, for example, that Columbia janitor. And the other one, this one where Mario Torres came out and spoke about what happened. That these guys were organized. They were focused. They tried to keep him against his will, thanks to the call, Gary. And because of that, he can't go back to campus. He says he's totally traumatized by it. So when we come back, I'm going to play that for Bill Hemmer, and we're going to get his take on that because, as you mentioned, they said these guys are totally out of control. A lot of them are not students. They said the way they painted the cameras, the way they took over the buildings, the way they knew where the vending machines were to block out the wall, and where the desks were able to be used, they cased the place. That's pretty clear. So let's just find out who's behind it. We know who benefits from it. You know who benefits from it? All our enemies over in the Middle East. You know, benefit from it, Russia and China. They can turn around to their people and say America pretends to be free, but they are not free. We know it's spin, but they don't. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Back with Bill Hemmer in a moment. Don't move.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
But the cross-exam, boy, her responses were disastrous. I mean, do you hate Donald Trump? Yes, of course she does. That's a big deal. When the witness hates the person whose liberty is at stake, that's a big damn deal. And she's putting out tweets, fantasizing about him being in jail. That really undermines the credibility. The fact that she owes him $500,000. She, by order of a court, owes Donald Trump $500,000 and said, I will never pay him. I will defy a court order. The defense is going to say she's willing to defy a court order. Why? She's not willing to respect an order of a judge. Why is she going to respect this oath she took? So I thought it went quite poorly on cross-examination.
So Eli Honig on CNN, they probably didn't want to hear that. There was like nine people there. Everyone kind of froze when he said it. Bill Hemmer's here, fresh off doing his show.
Just how you doing, brother? Nice to see you.
Been off for 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Bill's excited because he's got his Fox Nation special is now out. It's available right now. Battle for the Arctic with Bill Hemmer. Can you feel all your limbs yet?
In all candor, my right big toe was gone for a month.
A month.
It's all back.
All right, good. Your response to this.
I was watching that last night live, and I was like, whoa. But the other thing is that Honig was not in the courtroom, but the guy to his left was. And he was casting even more shade on the proceedings from yesterday. And he was sitting there watching all this. So I thought that was interesting. Also thought on Friday afternoon when Hope Hicks got off the stand, I was watching a lot of different cable nets trying to get what their take is. And I guess to your listeners, they have to be reminded that we have producers and reporters, some inside the courtroom, not many, but a few others in the overflow room because there's not a lot of room.
A lot of time it's better in the overflow room, right? Because you could see every angle.
That is, you're right about that because you can see the monitors.
Yeah.
And you cannot when you're inside the courtroom. I understand it's very tight and it's hard to see Trump because you're sitting behind him, et cetera, et cetera. But what we're doing here is we're literally reading our emails that our producers send us from downtown at the courthouse.
It's crazy, right?
So what this first guest last night on CNN said is that I was in the courtroom and here's what I saw. And this is why I think the jurors may not take kind to this. He was explaining how they were writing notes and then suddenly stopped when Trump's attorney was cross-examining her. And you can draw whatever conclusions you want. He wasn't sure. It was either I'm writing this down because this is important or I want to remember this later, or I'm not writing right now because I really want to know what she has to say. Honig picked up on that and said, you know, because Honig is doing what we're doing. He's reading the emails and trying to interpret what's going on inside the courtroom. It's really hard stuff to do here. I don't know if they've got a couple jurors on there who are going to be sympathetic to Trump.
You only need one, right?
Well, you only need one. You're right about that. And this whole idea about a mistrial, I respect the legal views of the people on the Fox News channel so much. Andy McCarthy is one of the most prolific legal writers you will ever find.
Yep.
He's never been wrong. Jonathan Turley is tremendous. Our people across the board believe that this judge shouldn't be on this case.
Absolutely not. If he cared about justice.
If that's the case, on Thursday morning, when they reconvene, he said 36 hours to think about this push for a mistrial. I don't know of a court case, and if you've got a lawyer who can get on your show and tell me otherwise, I would really like to hear. If the judge says, I think we've gone too far from the bench, well, you have gone too far. And you cannot expect a jury to just discard what they have heard.
Because they might be looking at the big case, not getting caught up in the who wrote raw check and just go, this president would take part in this.
Brian,
I'm going to write that.
And this is more important. This isn't just a regular case. We can call a mistrial and bring everybody back again. You're talking about a former president. It should be handled with the highest legal care. And we'll see what happens at 9:30 tomorrow when I'm sure the lawyers approach the bench and they'll probably talk for 20 minutes. And I don't know what will come out of that.
Well, there was no reason for her to go into detail about what she said happened between those two. And what the prosecutor said at one point was, hey, guys, you should have objected more in the defense. And the defense said, you told us what the parameters were. I think they were staying within the parameters. He goes, well, no, they went way too much. Gave us way too information. Back to your original point. So I don't know if Trump probably hit the roof on break after that.
Didn't show it.
Right.
On camera, he didn't show it. Another question I have for you is that in any trial, the lawyers will share at least one up to three witnesses who could potentially be called the next day. Like, they're on their list. And the judge said, you do not have an obligation to share your witness list with the defense because I'm afraid the defendant's going to go after them on social media. This may be a contrarian take. I don't know if I'm within the bounds of law or not. Neither one of us went to law school. If the judge is so concerned with that possibility, he should take action. And if he knows that $1,000 is not going to do the deal,
right,
then he should put Trump in jail. He said, if I cannot trust you,
right,
I'm going to put you behind bars to keep you quiet. And then we move back to the law and the legal proceedings. And if it is customary to share the witness list with each team, then do it that way.
Well, do you, I mean,
because if not,
you think it's
Brian,
that big of a deal, though?
All of this stuff is just, I mean, from where I come from, it just throws the door open for a mistrial, or it throws the door open for a massive reversal on appeal, which would not happen until 2025.
So right now, who's the big names left? Michael Cohen and Catherine McDougal.
Karen
McDougal. But I don't even know, people are saying, I don't think she should testify. Yeah, what are you going to say?
I say, I'm
it's all about who writes the check and where the money go.
A lot. I mean, based on yesterday, I imagine Karen McDougal will be on the stand, but I don't think she wants to, A, and I, B, I don't think she's relevant.
Yeah. So Michael
Cohen's the guy.
And then we're done in 2 or 3 weeks. And let me ask you something. I still, you know, people are like, well, Donald Trump's not going to go to jail. If they find him, find him guilty, what makes you think they're not going to find some type of jail term? This guy seems oblivious to the fact.
Yeah, Andrew Cherkasky, who I also I respect his mind. He said, can't you find an, this is 3 weeks ago. Said, can't you find another judge? We have more judges than that in New York. And Turley concludes his piece. I think this was in the New York Post, or maybe it was at FoxNews.com. He said, quote, you've got a judge who should have recused himself given his daughter major role as a Democratic activist and fundraiser.
Yeah.
He continues. You have a gag order that's allowing a New York State Supreme Court justice to regulate what the leading candidate for the presidency may say in an election on the weaponization of the legal system. You have a lead prosecutor, Matthew Colangelo, who not only left the Biden Justice Department to revive this case, but once worked for the Democratic National Committee. You have a case based on two dead misdemeanors shocked back into life by a still mysterious theory of an undefined crime.
It's crazy.
Shocked back to life. CPR. Bam.
All right. The other area, I just want to let you hear this. This is another CNN analyst, Cut 5, Paul Reed.
Right off the bat, Susan Nicholas got Stormy Daniels to admit that she hates Trump. She says, yes, I hate him. They point out the fact that Stormy Daniels has said publicly that she would, quote, dance if Trump went to jail. Stormy Daniels says, I don't owe him expletive, and I'll never give that orange turd a dime. Now, Daniels said that this tweet is in retaliation for what he says about her. Now, this is when it got really heated, because Nicholas confirms, you call him names all the time. And Daniels starts to sort of yell, saying yes, because he made fun of me first. I mean, this is devolving pretty quickly, right? This is pretty toddler-esque conduct and lack of accountability. But what the defense is very effectively getting at is Daniels' disdain for the defendant. So this so far has been a very effective and dramatic cross, and appears to continuing to become even more dramatic.
What was that on?
CNN.
Okay.
Paula Reed.
Couple of things here. The judge blamed Trump's lawyers for not objecting more.
Yes.
I think they had a standing objection to the entire time anyway. That's not common.
Evidently, there's a finite amount of objections, according to Alan Dershowitz, that you can make. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. And you know, Cherkasky was saying yesterday, he goes, I don't know why Trump's lawyers aren't more aggressive. And so another legal mind said, well, you want to be mindful of how the jury interprets the degree of intensity you have with your objections. And Cherkasky said, BS. He said, I'll object 1,000 times if I have to protect my client, which I thought was an interesting comment. But we weren't in the courtroom, Brian. We don't know. But the last comment about Friday afternoon, I was surprised, you know, just channel flipping.
Hope Hicks.
How many people, after Hope Hicks left the stand, how many legal analysts across the spectrum were saying, you know, she might have been better for him than it was for the state?
So the one thing that you have to, if the president is able to, if the former president is able to get off, he's going to have a lot of momentum coming out of this. No doubt about it. But if he gets convicted and he's still able to have his freedom, gets probation, whatever it is, they said maybe 4% of the people would vote differently. That could cost you the election.
It could. That was the ABC poll that came out over the weekend.
But I just think also it's faulty because people forget. That's why people are all cut up. Donald Trump can't campaign. I'm like, look, Mm-hmm. Which campaign are you really doing in May?
A couple of things.
It would help to go out and earn some money.
Yeah, a couple of things I would add on that. 2 months ago, the Wall Street Journal did a poll, too, I think, among Republicans, and the number was much higher than 4%. It was like 25% of the respondents said they would not vote for a convicted felon. The problem that Trump people have is that if you get a guilty verdict in this, you know, for 5.5 months, they're going to run these spots that, you know, could you vote for a convicted felon as your U.S. president? That'll be the spot. Over and over and over again. I don't know what happens to that 4% number you just mentioned. Maybe it goes down, maybe it goes up.
So let's turn, if we can, to some of the riots that we've been seeing in the streets. And before we get that, we know George Washington University finally took down all the Palestinian crap all over George Washington statue. We know they finally broke up the encampments there. But do you know they just did a poll in Axios? Did you guys run this today? And they said, what is most important? They asked college students, what's most important to you? Do you know that the conflict in the Middle East, Gaza, is ninth? Do you know healthcare, education, opportunities and funding, climate change, gun control, immigration? It's all ahead of it. Mm-hmm. But yet no one's out there for green energy necessarily. No one's out there for a healthcare access. They're out there for the ninth most important thing. How important do you think it is to get to the bottom of who's financing this, where that money's coming from, what the agenda is behind it? When you know fundamentally walking around campus, it's the ninth most important thing.
Yeah, you know, we had a woman on, a reporter from the Free Press earlier today, because there's this iconic picture from Columbia. And it's a picture before, like, before the world really noticed that they were going inside of the main hall. Was it Hawthorne Hall? What was it? I can't remember the main Hamilton Hall. Thank you. Administrative building there. Thank you very much. And there's a janitor in there. He's like 45 years old, and he's got this guy pinned up against a wall, and they got a picture of him, right? That was a 40-year-old agitator from Brooklyn who lives in a $2.3 million brownstone down the street from his parents who live in a $3.4 million brownstone. And, Brian, this is the first time we've really started to chip away about the identities and backgrounds of a lot of agitators.
Yeah, here is that's Mario Torres, the Columbia janitor. Cut 35.
I think it all comes down to the school, and it's not really public safety's fault. But I, even though I felt abandoned by them, but I think the school could have done more to A, prevent this, and to be there for us when we needed them. We don't expect to go to the work and get swarmed by an angry mob with rope and duct tape and masks and gloves. It's the last thing on our minds. You know, there's the issue. Was there security breaches before? Yes. Should there have been more security? Absolutely. Did we know about the history of that? No. But I'm sure some, like I said, someone did, and they should have protected us a little more. That's it. You know, public safety is two buildings down or up. They're in Lowe. I'm in Hamilton. I didn't see, even when I left the building, I didn't see one public safety officer. What's that about? You know what I mean? Were they told to stay in place or something? I don't know. But they didn't tell us that. We had to fight our way out. You understand?
Communication is just terrible everywhere.
Yeah. That's a father and a husband, and he's worried about losing his job.
Right.
Keep an eye on this story and see what Columbia does, whether or not they discipline him. But back to the story I told you.
Just hold that thought because we're going to come back. We're going to talk a little about your Arctic, too.
Oh, I love that.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Will China come here?
I think China definitely considers themselves a near Arctic nation, and what that means to them is they reserve the right to operate in this environment. They have icebreakers. They're building more. I think that the partnerships that they have up here are not clear to me. And so I'm not sure that Russia and China are on the same page on what the future of the Arctic holds.
The United States, conversely, has partners. What difference does that make?
It makes a tremendous difference. I mean, our ability to stage up here in these types of environment, to work with Canada in particular, is just something that no one can replicate. Russia and China cannot replicate that.
So that is a little of the Bill Hemmer Arctic special. It's called Battle for the Arctic with Bill Hemmer, available now exclusively on Fox Nation. And there's a battle up there. I mean, the Russians just wanted to take it, and China wants to take it and told us to get out. But we're not going to take that,
I think there are so many stories that are happening on the top of the world. The final frontier, I think you could argue, that a lot of people don't pay attention to it, but they need to. This was 3 days of an adventure that I had never had before in my life. Nothing even close. You were just listening to Admiral Caudle. Great guy. 4-star admiral. He'll be here for Fleet Week in New York in a couple weeks' time. You should meet him. He's terrific.
You going to bring him in?
Oh, yeah. He's already booked. Okay. So his main concern is that Putin's going to charge you for transit on certain routes over the Arctic. And you can see why there could be such an advantage for shipping, because you can cut off weeks for material that you could move around the world.
Is it because things are melting?
There is Arctic ice melt, and that's part of the reason why the area is changing so much. There are some who believe that the White House believes by the year 2030 that for a couple weeks during the summer, like late August or early September, you could get what's known as a blue Arctic, and you could actually go over the North Pole. But now listen, this is in the Mediterranean, Brian. You're going to have to go with nuclear-powered icebreakers, and Russia has those. We do not. We have two that belong to the Coast Guard. Russia's got 37, a handful of which are nuclear-powered. My point is, you'd be able to do it, but still you're going to need the icebreakers to go along in case you have a problem. So that's one aspect of the story. The other aspect of the story is China. China does not have any territory on the Arctic Circle. But in 2018, they declared themselves a near Arctic nation. No one else recognized it, but they cut a deal with the Norwegian government, and they set up a lab far, about 75 degrees north latitude, kind of where we were, up in the Beaufort Sea, Arctic Ocean. And they're studying the rare earth minerals, the natural gas, and the oil that you may at some point be able to extract from the Arctic Ocean beneath that ice. It was an amazing trip and made me think about things that I rarely have in my life. And thanks to the U.S. Navy for making that happen.
Yeah, that's great. And he's going to be here Fleet Week. Got to send him up to radio after.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Is that okay?
He'll talk about anything.
All right.
Great cat. I'll make sure that happens.
Oh, that'll be great. I also think it's going to be very interesting to see this new... Did you watch the Tom Brady roast?
I saw just bits and pieces of it. I have not watched the 3 hours.
I'm going to bounce something off you.
Go.
The age of political correctness and cancel culture is over.
Can you take the L out of lover because it's over?
Based I never heard that expression. Have you heard that expression?
Of course you have. You can find that.
I've never heard that expression.
You can find that in an old country song. Take the L out of lover, baby, because it's over.
When you see what they say.
I saw. I read some of the transcripts about his family. I was like, whoa. Pull it back, boys.
You see some Dave Chappelle. You thought that was big. This is off the charts. And I think it's good. They're the icebreakers. It's over. We're back to normal now, Bill Hemmer. We're going to watch you tomorrow, 9 to 11.
Thanks.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.